All right. Thank you, guys. That was beautiful. Hey, one thing I forgot to mention.
Sorry.
No.
I was asked very politely, and I completely forgot. The men's group, for if you didn't hear it last week, the men's groups on Monday nights are canceled for the time being until August. So don't show up here on Monday nights expecting a men's group. It won't be here. We will let you know when it starts back up. Sorry, I was supposed to say that earlier, and I forgot.
Yeah, that's very good. I was supposed to mention something, too. So we'll continue on with the announcements. I forgot to mention that the McAllisters, while they had a large portion of their trip funded, they are still in need of some funds. So if you're interested in donating to help them get there, you can make a donation to Eastgate Market. Market Matt and Chris in Africa. Excellent adventure to Africa. Whatever, just Market Matt and Chris or something like that, and we'll make sure that we get that to them. So pray about that and see how the Lord may lead in that way. Okay, we're going to continue our study in the Gospel of Mark today. And if you have a Bible or you would like to follow along with a Bible app or whatever, if you make notes, something like that, if you'll find your way to Mark chapter 5, please. Last week we finished up chapter 4 as we're going through this chapter by chapter, verse by verse, and we read about Jesus and his disciples facing a storm out on the Lake of Galilee and how Jesus calmed the storm with just a word and how everyone was fairly disconcerted by all of those events, both the storm and the calming of the storm. And we pointed out that those events, while I believe they happened, I believe that was a historical account, it also serves as like a historical parable. Images that help us to understand what it means to follow Jesus, what it's going to be like living this adventure of following after Jesus, how storms and chaos sometimes come with that, that you know, that's just part of the journey, but how those things also can be used by God to increase or to deepen our trust in God during those times. So today we're going to be moving from a meteorological storm to a spiritual storm localized inside of one man. What we're going to read today is actually a very strange story, especially for us as 21st century Americans who live in what Richard Beck has coined a disenchanted culture. In other words, it means that as modern Western Americans, we have by and large eliminated the spiritual plane out of our worldview. We don't really incorporate or include that in our thinking. So we're disenchanted that way. For a lot of progressive scholars, it just becomes easier to identify these stories as, you know, these stories in the Gospels, especially about demons and evil spirits, as being the product of primitive and, you know, superstitious ancients who just didn't know any better. You know, they will say, certainly, you know, we know there's no such thing as demons or evil spirits. This was an ancient way of coping with undiagnosed illnesses like epilepsy or bipolar disorders or dissociative personalities. And listen, here's the thing. It's true. The ancients certainly didn't know about things that we have discovered. Doesn't mean that our discoveries are somehow inaccurate. But I'm not willing to embrace the hubris of a modern age that assumes a superiority, that completely dismisses the observations that include a worldview that's beyond our sight and sense that way. I'm not willing to go so far as to say there's not something at work here that's more than meets the eye. And here's the thing. Typically as Christians, we struggle with this in terms of trying to keep a balance on this subject of demons and Satan and things like that. We either ignore the biblical claim of this reality or we obsess about it. It's one of those things. We seem to kind of drift back and forth between those two extremes. When I was in the crazy church, and you've heard me talk about that, but it was a church that kind of was the catalyst for why Eastgate is around. But in that crazy church, which was a charismatic kind of church, man, we obsessed about demons. I mean, it was, you know, that was full on. That's what, you know, we wanted to know where the demons were and how they were getting in and everything. So much so that I'm not kidding, we pretty much were superstitious people. We were about as superstitious as they get, and, you know, constantly worried about this or that's going to open a door to the devil and we're going to go through all of this stuff. So when I left the crazy church, I fell into the other extreme, and I'll acknowledge it. I mean, it was just easier for me to ignore this spiritual reality. Like, you know, let's don't talk about demons. But see, that's not appropriate either, because we would have to ignore or completely reinterpret whole swaths of the Bible if we deny the reality of spiritual forces at work, and especially when we're talking about this sense of evil spiritual force at work in the world. You've heard me mention the Bible Project, I think, over the years, but they have a series of videos that they've got all kinds of videos. If you haven't looked at the Bible Project, please do that, because it is a profound tool and resource for helping you to understand how this narrative of the Bible works. They've got series on themes and the actual books of the Bible as well. But they've got one on the biblical, understanding the biblical representation of spiritual beings. And I can't recommend them enough. And if you get a chance, watch them on YouTube. Take your phone and snap a shot of this screen, because there's the URL right there and you can go there easily. I've also linked it on Wonder What, our blog site that I do every week. It'll give you a good primer, give you a good perspective of how the biblical writers understood the way this spiritual realm is at work here in this world, and that helps us in understanding some of these things that are happening here in the gospel. So today, just to let you know, today we're going to encounter some supernatural stuff in our text, and the best thing I can think of to do is just get into it from here. So if you're there in Mark chapter 5, we will start with verse 1. It says, so they arrived, they being Jesus and his disciples. Remember, they got in the boat and were taken off to the other side of the lake. They got to the other side of the lake in the region of the Gerasenes. Now, depending on what translation of the Bible you're using right now, it's either going to say Gerasenes or Gadara or Gadarene, because we honestly really don't know where it is. There was a place called Gadarene that you know, some of the texts identify, but the problem with that place is that it was too far inland in the Decapolis region there. So other copyists thought, well, we'll fix that, and they put a different name of the town in closer to the coast. Fact of the matter is, we don't know. It doesn't make the text unreliable, because there's 2,000 years of history between us and the time that this was written. And it could very well have been that Gadarene was on the coast at one time, and who knows? Imagine Panama City in the ancient world after a storm comes through. Look, we lost, what, 30% of the population? So I could easily imagine a city relocating inland after something like that. We just have no idea, and it's ridiculous to even worry about it. The point is, you're thinking, nobody was worried about it. You brought it up. Doesn't matter. The point is, they're in the Decapolis. They're in that region. Remember, they went across the lake out of Jewish territory into Gentile territory. So they're here in this area called the Decapolis, the Ten Cities. Verse 2, when Jesus climbed out of the boat, a man possessed by an evil spirit came out from a cemetery to meet him. This man lived among the burial caves and could no longer be restrained, even with a chain. Whenever he was put into chains and shackles, as he often was, he snapped the chains from his wrists and smashed the shackles. No one was strong enough to subdue him. Day and night, he wandered among the burial caves and in the hills, howling and cutting himself with sharp stones. Okay, we'll stop there. It's quite a picture, isn't it? I mean, so, you know, Jesus and his disciples, they make it through this storm across the lake, and when they get to shore, they're greeted by this monster man all of a sudden that lunges at them. And, you know, you think about it, one thing that I thought about is that, you know, you notice Jesus never told the disciples where they were going, I mean, necessarily, or why they were going, or what they were up to. Like, they didn't know anything about this journey. If Jesus had said to them, hey, guys, let's get in a boat, we're going to face a storm and then get attacked by a wolf man, you want to go? They'd be like, no, I think I'm good here. And that's the thing we realize about our journey with Christ, is that, you know, we're not always going to know where it's going to lead us. Some things are going to surprise us along the way, but it's okay, because Jesus is with us, and that's what we see here. Now, the text indisputably attributes this man's condition to the work of an evil spirit, something that has taken control of his mind and his body and is actively working to destroy him. And so this is what we would call a person suffering from demon possession, something that has taken away his ability to function on his own. And it's an extreme condition that he finds himself in. But our first takeaway from this text, one of the things that I just want to mention and reinforce in this, because it's something that we as Westerners have to kind of grapple with a little bit. But the basic thing that we take away from this text is that there are forces at work, evil forces that oppose God's good in this world. I mentioned it before, but there's a psychiatrist named M. Scott Peck. He's passed away now, but he wrote a book back in the 80s called Glimpses of the Devil. And the reason he wrote this book was that his work led him to conclude that for some people, the only explanation for what was happening in their lives, after he had exhausted every other possibility in trying to diagnose and figure out what was happening with them, the only conclusion he could come to was that this was the work of hostile spiritual forces in their lives. And here's the thing. The Bible represents this as a reality to us, but it never gives us an explanation about it. It states it as an ipso facto. This is a reality. There are spiritual forces at work. They're hostile. They're out to destroy with no explanation. Like, how does that happen? How did this guy get into this state? That would have been useful information, I think, but the Bible kind of leaves that out, maybe to keep us from being superstitious, because there's actually a bigger point in this whole text. But, you know, we encounter this. We encounter the reality of evil spiritual forces right off the bat in the Bible. I mean, in the creation story, you think about it. And honestly, the creation story is almost like getting to a movie late. You ever go to the movie and, you know, you're going to get popcorn and the line's really long. And finally, when you get in there, the movie's already started and you're thinking, what's happening? What's going on in here? And the creation account is like that to me. All of a sudden, we've got this good, beautiful, created world that God has. And he's saying, this is really good. And suddenly there's this serpent who shows up and he's working against God's creative order. But we're not told why. We're not told where this came from. There are other little clues that kind of get introduced in the language of the text later on through the Bible. But even there, it's not definitive. You can't say, like, ipso facto, Isaiah was talking about the origin of the devil. There's nobody can say that for sure. In fact, it's, you know, there's a lot of mystery to this. And as soon as somebody starts spouting off some detailed demonology, I start getting nervous because the Bible just does not provide that to us. There's a mystery to this whole thing. And don't let that trouble you. Don't let that distress you, because we'll get to why it's not a big problem right now. But I think it's sufficient to acknowledge as a reality that there is this spiritual force or forces at work to oppose God's creative order and at work to destroy God's good creation. That's what we see happening. In fact, this man in the text becomes for us an extreme example of kind of what goes on in the world at large, what's going on in this conflict that we find ourselves, how people's lives are influenced by this. Well, let's look at this guy's situation. The first thing we notice is that this man is isolated. Isolation is a part of this thing. The man was cut off from any sort of meaningful community. He's out and away. He's siloed into his own miserable state, his own little private hell of madness that he's involved in. That urge to be alone, that urge to be away, to disconnect from others, from family, from friends, that's not always something good happening there. It's usually a warning sign that we have to pay attention to, even in our own lives, if something like that is taking place or we find that urge happening. And listen, I'm not saying that if you find yourself withdrawing from community, you know, going back away from friends or whatever, I'm not saying in that you're demon-possessed or something like that. Please understand. Please hear what I'm saying. I am not saying that. Remember, this man's an extreme and a rare kind of an example. But I am saying, had me nervous just for a second. Okay. But I am saying that this is something to take note of, because it may be an influence from something that is malevolent. It may not just be our own natural responses to things. It's definitely not God. And it may be something else at work there. Maybe something else trying to influence us away from God's good in life. You see what I'm saying in that? The second characteristic is hopelessness. He's sitting there in this graveyard. He's surrounded by death, and there's this sense of loss and finality associated with him. And again, if we find ourselves wallowing in hopelessness, obviously there's a lot of reasons to feel overwhelmed and emotionally drained and stressed because of what we've gone through. People are still going through very difficult times after this hurricane. But sometimes we'll find ourselves tipping over into something deeper than that, a despair, a hopelessness that becomes overwhelming, that we find ourselves just swallowed by and drawn into. There may be something more to that than just our emotional response to circumstances. There may be something else at work in that, something to pay attention to. The third characteristic is his wild behavior. You know, they're trying to chain him up and he can't be changed. We could say living without restraint, or better yet, living in a way that dehumanized him. He can't even, you know, he's just howling all night. He's just off the chain. Those urges, those impulses to live without any restraint of social bearing or any restraint of morality, that urge to overindulge, to race off and try to escape through substance abuse or casual sex or overeating or all of those things that are part of living without restraint. There's a force at work pushing people in that direction to undo God's good created order. And that leads to the final characteristic of self-destructive behavior. And this is the end goal, as it appears in this text anyway. That appears to be the main thing that this malevolent spiritual force is up to destroy God's good creation. So it's kind of an overview. I mean, this text, this guy's one example, gives us sort of an overview of what's going on in this world and in life as we're experiencing it. Now, if you're thinking, you know, Rob, I deal with some of those things. I mean, I have those things going on in my life. What are you saying about me? I mean, what am I supposed to do about something like that? Well, look, as I said, the man in the text is an extreme example of what's happening in general. So my point is that those are characteristics that we can now be aware of. We don't just automatically assign that to saying, well, this is kind of how I am, or, you know, this is just the way it is for me, or my family's always been like that. Recognize and realize, you know what, there's something else going on here as well. We don't have to own those characteristics that we may see developing or happening, experiencing in our lives. We don't have to own those. And I'll tell you, the Bible actually gives us a very simplistic kind of response. And I say simplistic not in a pejorative kind of way, but it's a very simple thing that the Bible tells us to do. You can find it in James 4:7. James writes to us, surrender to God, resist the devil, and he'll run from you. And if we find ourselves, and again, I'm oversimplifying, so understand, I'm acknowledging there is a lot of complexity to the things that we experience and that we go through. But when we look at the simple instructions that the Bible actually provides to us, there is hope even in what's in this. If we find ourselves sinking into that hopelessness or wanting to isolate or any of those things that we talk about in that, we can recognize it for what it is. We can acknowledge it before God. This is a part of that surrender. You know, God, I feel hopeless and I know that's not from you. And so, you know, I ask for you to inspire your hope in me, and then resist that urge to sink into despair or to hide from friends or family or whatever. And when we say resist, you know, resist just means to go the opposite way. You know, to resist, if somebody's grabbing you by the arm and pulling you one way, to resist means you're going to exert force in the opposite direction. And so that may be on a spiritual level. We're just going to have to exert force spiritually. We're going to spend some time praying about these things, seeking God about it. But listen, it can be a lot more practical than that. It may mean, you know, going ahead and setting up an appointment with a counselor somewhere, getting some time to talk about these things, getting a more positive focus and view about how it is that we manage and navigate through these things and not allow those things to dominate our identity and confuse us into thinking this is who we are. Does that make sense? Do you see what I'm saying in that? It's resisting is more than just, you know, jumping up and saying, I rebuke you, devil, or whatever. That was the crazy church world. But it's exerting that energy in an opposite direction, finding an outlet for that energy in a way that's healthy and positive and that cooperates with God's good creative order. Okay, so God's intent for our lives is the exact opposite of those evil forces here. We think about how God is at work and what he does in our salvation experience, which is this, you know, it's not just going to heaven when we die, but it's this ongoing redemption that's taking place in our lives. And so God's intent is to draw us into community. Notice that that's, you know, it's rare that God's ever saying, you know, go away from everybody. And you know, the very first thing Jesus does when he comes on the scene is draw community around. And the 12 apostles, he gets this community going right away. And then God inspires hope in our hearts. If we ever find ourselves struggling, trying to figure out, you know, is this God, you know, trying to alert me about something or is this, you know, is this God trying to convict me? The way you determine the distinction between conviction and condemnation is that conviction always comes with hope. There's always a sense that, yes, this can be different. This can be different. Condemnation just comes with the, yeah, you're a loser and that's it. You know, might as well just give up. And that's not God. God inspires hope, even with conviction, even if we see there are areas in our lives that need to be submitted to him. God restores our sense of nobility and humanity by enabling us to live in ways that reinforce that nobility. In other words, enabling us to live with a certain moral restraint, with a certain social restraint. So we're not just out, you know, unchained in the world. God's ongoing intent is to give us life and to promote what leads towards healthy life, whatever's going to build us up, whatever's going to lead us into redemption, regardless of where we've been or what we struggle with. That is God's purpose. That's God's ongoing work in us. And here's the thing. The enemy cannot stop what God is intent on doing in our lives. If we've surrendered to God, if we're looking to see God move and lead us into redemption, our enemy, this enemy that's at work, this dark, malevolent force that's at work cannot stop what God is doing in us. And that gets highlighted in the next section. So let's keep reading. When Jesus was still some distance away, the man saw him, ran to meet him, and bowed low before him. With a shriek, he screamed, "Why are you interfering with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? In the name of God, I beg you, don't torture me." For Jesus had already said to the spirit, "Come out of this man, you evil spirit." Then Jesus demanded, "What's your name?" And he replied, "My name is Legion, because there are many of us inside this man." Then the evil spirits begged him again. We notice we're into the plural there. Begged him again and again not to send them into some distant place. There happened to be a large herd of pigs feeding on a hillside nearby. "Send us into those pigs," the spirits begged. "Let us enter them." Jesus gave them permission. The evil spirits came out of the man and entered the pigs, and the entire herd of about 2,000 pigs plunged down the steep hillside into the lake and drowned in the water. We'll stop there for a moment. No explanation needed there. We'll move along. Okay, look, hey, it's a weird passage. I mean, I'm just saying, it is, it's, you know, at least to me. Once again, the evil spirits are declaring Jesus' identity, and once again, Jesus shuts that down. He wants no part of that. But the exchange between these evil spiritual forces and Jesus is perplexing. Clearly, there is sentience here. There's personality expressed. There is intelligence expressed. They beg not to be tortured or sent away into some distant place. And that's a thing? I mean, those are the questions I ask in this. Jesus says very little in this whole exchange. You know, come out of this guy, basically. It's unclear in the original language whether or not he is, when he's saying, "What's your name?" It's unclear as to whether or not Jesus is actually talking to the man or talking to this demonic spiritual forces at that point. He may have been speaking to the man, trying to draw him back to his humanity, asking what his name is. Tell me your identity here. But the demons just chime in. That's a possibility. I don't know for sure. We also see that there's basically a horde of spiritual forces inside this guy. And how did that work? We're not told. In the strangest part of the story, to me, the demons ask not to be disembodied. Then they ask to have permission to invade a herd of pigs who kill themselves then by running off a cliff, which then disembodies those spirits after all. But the minimal details that we get in this give us the slightest insight behind the curtain. Somehow, these evil spiritual forces are tortured by being disembodied. Why? I don't know. How? Not sure. We're not told. It would be pointless for me to speculate. And believe me, I have heard way more people speculate on this than I care to remember. And there's a lot of people who are very confident about how all this works. I'm not one of them. I would prefer to stick with what the Bible actually reveals to us. And like I said, that is frustratingly little in this. And of course, you know, the question about these poor pigs. I mean, you know, why did Jesus let this evil do that to these poor little pigs? I mean, apart from inventing deviled ham, I don't see a whole lot of point to this. It just seems cruel. Yeah, okay. Everybody was feeling it. I know. You were just able to be honest and vocal about it. Honestly, I have not found a satisfactory answer, explanation for this, why it went down the way it did. What I do recognize, and we all have to realize, is that the ancient world would not have viewed this or read this the way we as moderns do. We've got to acknowledge and recognize that right off the bat. They didn't have movies like Bambi or Babe or Charlotte's Web or anything like that. It's one of those robocalls, man, and I got to turn my ringer off. You get robocalls all the time? It's horrible, isn't it? Anyway, I should have answered and made them talk to you. But they didn't have movies like Charlotte's Web or something like that that anthropomorphize animals. So they had a very different view about animals than we would have today. They wouldn't have seen this the way we would look at it. I'm not saying that was better or whatever. I'm just saying it was very utilitarian in that. And in fact, when I was in South Sudan, he was talking about how we made that trip. And, you know, one of the things that we do is we'd share our stories in a group at one point. And one of the guys that was with us shared a story about his dog, about, you know, how their dog was like a member of the family. And as soon as he said that part, he was like a member of the family, the place busted out laughing. That was the funniest thing they'd ever heard. The thought of having a pet that you would treat like a member of the family was absurd to them. So we've got to realize the ancient world was not reading this the way we might read it. And remember that Jewish readers especially were going to make the clear connection between pigs and ceremonial uncleanness, you know, the idea of the abstention from pork. So they would have definitely read it differently. For us moderns, we just have to see it for what it is, shrug, and move on. Some of it's a mystery to us. It's going to remain a mystery. But there are some things that are very clearly shown to us, and I think they're the most important parts of this. And that is that Jesus has absolute power in this situation, up against some evil that still carries with it mystery. There's no mystery for Jesus, and there is no flinching from his side. There isn't even a struggle described here from Jesus' side of this thing. It is absolute, certain power from his perspective. And as we said before, this spiritual enemy has no power to stop what God is doing in our lives. And I love how this all goes down, because in this scene, Jesus never backs down and he never backs away from this crazy dude. He recognizes what's at work and he looks past all the crazy to see the human being at the center of it all. And that, I think, is really important. It's another reminder that nobody is off limits from receiving God's healing grace. There's nobody who's outside the bounds of his ability to demonstrate grace or to help or to heal. You know, Jesus, when they get off the boat and this guy is screaming out of the graveyard at them, Jesus, you know, didn't say, you know, just keep moving, guys. Fellas, don't make eye contact, because, you know, just keep going. Which I'm afraid I would have done given that situation. But Jesus was different. He went straight to the man in order to bring deliverance and healing to him. And this is an emphatic statement in this story. Jesus is identifying the real enemy at work here. There is an enemy at work, and it is not one of our fellow human beings. Jesus recognized that there is this malevolent spiritual force at work which animates human greed and selfishness and violence and lust, all of the things that drag human beings into the chaos, into the darkness, the things that dehumanize us. There is this force doing that. In the Bible Project, Tim Mackey says, Jesus came on the scene and saw the evil and pain in this world as a symptom of the world being held captive to this spiritual evil force. And within that view, no one is off limits. Within that view, all prejudice has to be eliminated and gone. No one is beyond God's healing grace. That's an important view for us to have as his followers. It's an important reminder that the us versus them mentality that seems to want to dominate our culture is not God's point of view. When we find ourselves thinking in terms of us versus them, we have to recognize what that is, and it is not God. Here's what I want you to think about, and this is pretty important. You have never met in your life, you have never met someone who doesn't matter to God. That person does not exist. And it's important that we keep that in mind. God sees human beings in need of healing and grace. And it's important for us to see that as well. Okay, well, let's quickly move along here. The pigs run off the cliff. They drown. Verse 14. The herdsmen fled to the nearby town and surrounding countryside, spreading the news as they ran. People rushed out to see what had happened. The crowd soon gathered around Jesus, and they saw the man who had been possessed by the legion of demons. He was sitting there, fully clothed and perfectly sane, and they were all afraid. Then those who had said, I think we're supposed to laugh there. I think that's right. Then those who had seen what had happened told others about the demon-possessed man and the pigs, and the crowd began pleading with Jesus to go away and leave them alone. Okay, another startling turn in the story here. The locals gather around. They see this guy who had formerly been a monster in their community, but now he's regained his dignity. He's sitting there all good, probably speaking with a British accent at this point, And their reaction is to be afraid. It's just the opposite of what we would have thought it would have been. They should have been afraid when the guy was a madman and been really stoked that he's normal around them now. But that's the thing. It wasn't the man who made them afraid. It was Jesus. And this goes back to what we talked about last week, that Jesus introduces us to a new reality, and that oftentimes is disconcerting for us. They'd accepted the madness of this man. This is the way Joe is. If you're Joe here, I didn't mean it like that. I'm sorry. There you are. That's just the way Joe is. But that's, it wasn't Joe. But they knew to avoid him. Don't avoid Joe because he's the nicest guy I know. But they knew to avoid him. He was just part of the way the world was as they knew it. That's just how this worked. But Jesus comes along and he disrupts that reality, and they are not into it. And this is the unfortunate thing about this. This is an unfortunate reminder that God's grace is not always welcomed. It will not always be welcomed. It's a great message. It's a great hope, but not everybody wants it. It's likely that the locals were also upset because this, loss of these pigs represented a loss of an economic setback. And that in itself becomes a parable about the world's system. But really, honestly, for some people, the idea of God's grace invading this world and healing and setting things right is a terrible thought. There's some people who like this world just like it is. They like the way it is. It's easier for them to live in a way that advances themselves through stepping on someone else's neck or doing whatever is necessary in order to advance themselves. And they like that system. They don't want any sort of reality like Jesus offers. That's a sad reality. Like we said before, it doesn't mean anybody's beyond hope, But we see this represented in the world that we live in now. And we'll see that Jesus doesn't argue with them on this. Jesus didn't push back, you know. He didn't set out to, you know, I'll show you I got a right to be here and I'll set up some laws that allow me in this region. He doesn't force himself on the unwilling. And so let's look at what Jesus does. As Jesus was getting into the boat, and there's where I want to stop just for a second. Jesus doesn't force his grace. And that's something else we have to remember and keep in mind. But you know what else? He's getting back in the boat to head back over. This shows us that the whole reason Jesus made this trip, goes through storm, and comes all the way over into Gentile territory is for this one guy. And then he heads on out. He was there. We would sing a song, you know, you're the one who leaves, how's it go? You're the one who never leaves one behind or something along those lines. I mean, that's what we see actually demonstrated here in Jesus' own story. For this one dude, Jesus goes through all of this just to test. That's an impressive revelation about God's grace. So anyway, he gets in the boat. We keep reading here, still in verse 18. The man who had been demon-possessed begged to go with him. But Jesus says, no, go home to your family. Tell them everything the Lord has done for you and how merciful he's been. So the man started off to visit the 10 towns, that's the Decapolis, that region, and began to proclaim the great things Jesus had done for him. And everyone was amazed at what he told them. And that's where we'll stop today. So the same guy who screamed at Jesus when he shows up, you know, like a monster, now he is upset by Jesus' departure. And so there's this rhythm in the story. You know, we've come back full circle. And there's distress, but it's a different kind of distress. He doesn't want Jesus to leave, whereas before he wanted him out. And this guy wants to go with Jesus. And again, another interesting part of this story, Jesus denies this request. Now, this one we can kind of think through a little more logically, because this is very likely a Gentile person. He's in a Gentile region there. And there was an order to how it is that God was bringing Messiah into the world. And Jesus, you know, the Messiah was coming first to the Jews and then to the Gentiles. And so, you know, if he'd have gone back over to Israeli territory with a Gentile now in tow, it would have changed the whole dynamic of what it was that he was going to have to be ministering about. He was going to have to be defending his choice of having this guy, and it would have subverted what it was that he was trying to reveal. Jesus, I believe, knew that before long, Gentiles were going to be included in this whole thing. And so, kind of like in advance of that, Jesus deploys this guy with a mission. Kind of like, lay the groundwork. Let's get this thing going, because this is about to bust loose in the world. So he says, go tell your family what God's done and how merciful he's been. And what a simple and beautiful message that is, right? Like, go tell your family what it is that God's done and how merciful he is. That's actually the message that the early church, the first church had. They went out with that, telling everybody the wonderful things that God had done, his great mercy in salvation, and it turned the world upside down. And so we recognize here that God's healing grace in our lives comes with a commission to share that grace, to pass that grace along. This wasn't, you know, Jesus saying go back to your family was not a call for this guy to be comfortable. Because remember what a crazy dude he was. You know, to go back to family wasn't like, yay, I got to go back to family. It's like, oh, I got to go back to those guys. They had me in chains at one point. You remember that, Jesus? So, you know, they saw him as a madman. He was going to have to, there was going to have to be some, you know, fence mending and stuff. It was going to have to take some time for his family and those closest to him to see that changes had taken place, that he was different. He'd have to live that change out and then speak about that change that had taken place, describe it. And the message was simple. Talk about how merciful God is with the people that are closest to him. And that's really what the commission in our lives is all about. Talk about how merciful God is to the people that are closest to us, our families, our neighbors, our coworkers, and then see where it goes from there. See what God may lead or unfold, you know. This guy was only sent to the people closest to him, but it branched from there into all of the cities of the Decapolis. And it says the people were amazed. I don't know if that means it was effective or not, but either way, it got everybody's attention and certainly laid the groundwork for what was to come later on. But it starts with this simple commission. Go to those who are closest to you and be willing to share about how merciful God is. You know, sometimes we may feel like we don't want to talk about you know, our relationship with God. I try to keep my religion quiet. You know, I don't want to make waves or whatever. And we get afraid sometimes. I think in talking with people, I've heard this expressed, you know, I don't want to really get into a conversation where, you know, they might ask something I don't know about. You know, what if they bring up, you know, something about predestination? I don't want to talk about that. I don't understand that. I don't want anything to do with it. Or, you know, I don't know how to draw that diagram very well of the chasm between God and humans and the cross going on. I'm uncomfortable with all of that. And you know, when we think about that, we get worried, we get stressed about the potential of somebody asking a question we don't know about. The thing we have to ask is, what sort of theology did this guy have when Jesus sent him out on a mission like this? Like, what did he know? Did he even know Jesus as God? I think that's unlikely. Did he have any concept of salvation like we would understand salvation today? I think it's very improbable that he did. He wasn't told to go, you know, explain everything about the nuances of God's work in the world. He wasn't told to go warn everybody that they're going to hell. He didn't have to memorize the four spiritual laws when he ran out there. His message was simple. I was hopeless. I was broken. I was lost. And Jesus brought me out of the graveyard and gave me a new life. Simple message. And that's what we're commissioned to share as well. The simple story of what it is that God has done in our lives, the hope that we have, to be prepared to explain why we are the way we are. But that also means that there's a way we're meant to be when we follow Jesus. There's a way in which we're meant to interact with each other, a love we were called to demonstrate and reveal, to show that there's a distinction between the madness of this world and the grace that God reveals. To be ready to share with somebody why it is that we're a little bit odd that way. Why we're not afraid to be kind or to love the unlovely. So I'll tell you what, we're past Memorial Day now. We're into the summer. Maybe we can make this like a challenge for ourselves this summer. To make it a kind of a goal that we set in mind. Maybe to get to know one of our neighbors better. Just to begin to know them and to see how it is we can express, both through our actions and even with our words, this grace of God. See to it that grace is permeating our neighborhood as well. Maybe at the workplace. Maybe there's a coworker that you haven't known well. Maybe you make it a goal this summer, not to make them a project, but for your own sake, to be a part of this activity of God's kingdom expanding in this world, just to get to know someone, to share God's love with them. This is what Jesus commissioned that guy to do. I believe he's commissioned us to go to those closest and nearest to us and share about God's grace. God's been so good to us. He's been so merciful in our lives. Let's go spread that mercy around and see how it changes the world around us. Right on? All right, very cool. Why don't you stand up with me, if you will, please. God, we just pray that you do this in our lives, that we're challenged by this. We acknowledge and we recognize there are forces at work that are beyond what we're able to see in the immediate. But we also know, Lord, that you have complete and total authority and rule over all of those things. And so help us to be a people who are continually submitting and surrendering to you, to be a people who walk with you and resist all of those influences that would seek to dehumanize us, that would lead us away from your perfect love, that would undo the good order that you bring to life. I pray, Father, that you encourage every heart here to move in that direction, to embrace the grace that comes from you, and then share that abroad. Help us be those people, Lord. Help us be people that can rightly represent your kingdom in this world. And I pray that for us, Lord, in Jesus' name. Amen.